want to know how to find it. Seek it out when they hide it. You know it's in the bag when it's an easy grab. But come on, take a chance now. So go, 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 geocache, geocache. And if you need help, we're right there in a flash. If you got a question, just call in and ask. Uncover the stash on the Geocaching Podcast. The Geocaching Podcast.
Welcome to the Geocaching Podcast, episode 350, recorded live on May 7th, 2014. I'm your host, Ted Hard Hat, with
Daryl W4 and
Scott Burks.
You can join us via our chat room or watch us live video stream, plus participate with us while we record this episode. All this and more can be found at www.geocachingpodcast.com/live. Be sure to contact us via our voicemail line at 630-31-VOICE. Also find us on Twitter at geocachingpodcast.com/Twitter and Facebook at geocachingpodcast.com/Facebook. This episode is sponsored by cache-advance.com for all your geocaching needs. Cache-advance.com. Go find it. All right. Well, welcome, folks, to the Geocaching Podcast. And we got a really, really good show with you and a fun guest that we've had on in the past, but we never get enough of. We got Fire and Ice on with us tonight. Hey. How you doing, gentlemen?
Hello.
I'm good. Doing pretty well.
Oh yeah, that's good. Yeah, it's been a week. Not too much geocaching wise this week for me. We had an absolute gorgeous day in North Kakalaki, where it was in the 80s, very sunny, beautiful, and of course that's when the honeydew hit. So yes, the famous honeydew list of you need to get this done or else, and yes, dear. So the geocaching got put on the back burner. How about Daryl, you got to get out, didn't you?
Yeah, I've actually gotten a cache every day so far this month, at least one, sometimes more. Not that that's necessarily, you know, intentional. It's just kind of been, you know, oh, here's a cache over here I can go grab today and over here. So I'm kind of trying to keep it going now since it's, you know, the first 4 or 5 days of the month I got one. So now it's like, okay, now I'm going to try to keep it going for a while. I kind of don't want to break my 123-day streak from previously, though, so I'm not sure how long I'm going to keep it going.
No, it sounds great, but you guys are actually getting much more of a heat temperature rise up there, aren't you? Because I know down here we're actually talking about going, like, pushing close to 100 for a couple days.
Yeah. Hey. Now, I think, Scott, you had, like, 80-degree temps today, correct?
No, it was like we were supposed to, but it hit. I'm not even sure if it hit the 70s. It was warm.
Oh, okay.
Tomorrow's supposed to be high 80s tomorrow.
Yeah, we've been like mid 50s the last couple of days, I want to say, but tomorrow we're supposed to get up to 78.
Well, hey, you know, the slush is finally a melting, and hopefully I'll get word that my brother up in Gaylord can get through the pass.
Maybe.
We'll have to see.
Yeah, it's Gaylord. You never know.
You just don't. Scott, how about yourself? I heard you found a really cool coin.
Yeah, this weekend I took my kids and the cache of Shortenits. We went up to DuPage County. It's a county in the Chicagoland area. And every year for about 3 years now, I think they have a 2012, 13, and 14, they give a coin. You got to find 5 out of 8 caches, I think. You know, the old Passport series, you know. Mm-hmm. And we went and got 2013's coin over the weekend, me and the boys in Shortenits. We found 5 caches, got the coins. The boys had a great time. And so I think this weekend we're going to go get 12 and 14 this weekend.
Awesome. I love stuff like that.
Yeah, it's brilliant. You know, it's such a great idea to do. Get you to that county and, you know, to, you know, spend money in their stores. It's a brilliant idea.
Oh, yeah, it's an awesome thing, and hopefully a lot of communities are going to find out just that. You bring the geocachers, the economy will come with it. That's a cool thing.
Absolutely.
All right, Daryl, let's go over the podcast roundup, letting our viewers know what's going on in the geocaching podcasting community. What's coming up this week on GeoGearHits?
This week we're doing our first puzzles show with Jennifer of Team AJK, who's also the author of the Geocaching Puzzle of the Day blog.
Awesome. And GeoSnippets Reboot Podcast this week, Amy and I are, yes, it's spring for the Northern Hemisphere, and it's time to do some geocache upkeep and replacement. I'm going to just go sit in the corner. So, yes, geocaching maintenance, good stuff to know, and a good reminder for everybody to get out there and get their geocaches up to snuff, or if you're down in the Southern Hemisphere, able to get it down into snuff. So we'll be talking about that tomorrow on the GeoSnippets Reboot Podcast. All right, let's go over the geocaching question of the day.
Geocaching question of the day. Hey, cachers. I'm Lookout Lisa from Cache Advance, your host for the geocaching question of the day. Well, I've been caching since 2002, and I've been in the business of geocaching since 2005. Monday through Thursdays, we ask our followers on Twitter, Facebook, and Google+ a question about geocaching. We recently asked, how often do you perform maintenance on your own geocaches? Well, after tallying the answers, we found that maintenance seems to run on about three different schedules for most cachers. About a quarter of you do maintenance runs quarterly, or 3 to 4 times a year. I think the changing of the seasons might be a good trigger to go out and check on your caches. Easy to remember, and often different seasons need different types of camouflage. 10% of cachers will check on a cache if it hasn't been found in a year. Authorized users on Twitter shared, "We perform cache maintenance at least one times a year, and we always check on them when two or more post a DNF." And 65% of you report doing maintenance when needed, as dictated by needs maintenance logs, or one or more DNF logs. So Finn on Facebook summed it up very nicely when he said, "Mostly just when logs indicate they need it. But if I happen to be out near one of my caches, I'll sometimes stop by just to check on things." Well, hey, we really enjoyed hearing about geocache maintenance, and you can too if you follow us, Cache Advance, on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, for the geocaching question of the day. Thanks, and happy caching.
Well, thank you, Lisa, from Cache Advance. We really do appreciate everything that you do for the show. And, yeah, it's maintenance is an important thing, and just goes to show you that it's going to be a great topic to talk about tomorrow on GeoSnippets Reboot Podcast. Yes, a selfless ploy. Here we go. Tonight, episode 350, Earth Caching, and we've got a special guest on tonight and has been on the show in the past, and we are glad to have him back. We have Fire and Ice. Hey, how's it going? And welcome to the show.
Good, good. Glad to be here.
Man, I'll tell you what, the first thing when we started talking about in recent past about upcoming shows and we brought up Earth Caching, your name came up first as far as when it comes to Earth Caches in of itself. But before we dig into all that fun stuff, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself as a geocacher and then how you got so interested into Earth Caches?
Well, you know, geocaching, I probably kicked in like a lot of other people. You buy a GPS and then you try to figure out what you're going to do with it. And I guess I started about the same time as you, Andy, where we just kind of
way in the
2008, way back in 2008. Yeah. And, but yeah, I just looked and there was one a block from my house and I wandered over and couldn't find the stupid thing and went back like four more times because it tormented me. And who would have thought that you could hide it? Cache in a you know guardrail that was that was about a block from my house, so I did that for a while, and then I kind of caught the bug, and every day at lunchtime I'd go grab some nearby, and every day after work, and that went on for a year or two, but that just kind of racked up the numbers, but it was something I could do just by myself, just to get out and do something. And so I was kind of the lone cacher off by myself for a while till I started to make friends in the neighborhood and then started to take a few trips out here and there.
Now you're actually you're out west, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm in Utah, in the Provo, Utah area, just south of Salt Lake. And I'm from central or southern Utah. So I grew up just outside of, north of, Bryce Canyon and Capitol Reef National Park.
Okay. So what kind of terrain is that there? Is that more desert or what do you come up against?
The term that most people use around here is like high mountain desert, because we are, you know, very, you know, the valleys are 5,000 feet.
Wow.
And so the mountains will carry you to 10 or 11,000 feet, but you're, you know, it's very dry. I know we're getting rain today, looking out the window, but in my hometown typically got like 11 inches of rain a year. Which was probably what you guys get in a day out there.
Yeah, no doubt, especially hurricane season. The when you have for Utah, I keep picturing all these amazing rock formations and different types of things that would be absolutely perfect for earth caching. Is that what got you into it?
Into earth caching, you know, I'd been working as a reviewer for a couple years, and you know, I did a few earth caches here and there, and really enjoyed them. I worked on one with a friend that was in one of the state parks here nearby, and worked on an earth cache with him and published it. And then at that point, if you guys remember, GeoAware was doing all of the earth cache reviewing around the world, which I can't imagine the hundreds and hundreds of submissions that came in. And he kind of came to Groundspeak and said, I need help. And, you know, Groundspeak asked reviewers, who would like to help? And so I think three or four of us raised our hands and kind of got, you know, tossed into the mix.
Wow. So what kind of preparation did it take going from a reviewer that's used to the standard geocaching fare into the much more in-depth end of earth caching?
First of all, it's, you know, I don't think you can do it without some knowledge of geology. And so actually when they asked me if I'd do it, I said, you know, growing up in the mountains and in the West, I said, if I'm going to do it, give me the Rocky Mountain area and desert Southwest, because that's kind of the geology that I was familiar with and that I'd studied in high school and college, where, you know, throwing something on the coast, I wouldn't have any idea, or, you know, not as much familiarity with coastal erosion or something like that. So, you know, it's a big difference in the most geocaches come to you ready to publish. The people are experienced, they've done a number of caches, or they've had friends help them, and so a lot of caches are just ready to go. And on the other hand, very few earth caches are ready to go. And so you tend to do a lot more work and a lot more email and work with the different cachers to get their cache to meet the guidelines. It's always an issue that people don't read guidelines. They decide to make a cache, or any kind of cache, and will go out and say, I've seen a traditional or a puzzle like this before, so they copy it and do their own. Earth caches, they just kind of toss stuff in there. And a lot of times it's really, we get a lot of people who want to make a virtual and can't find a way to make a virtual, so they assume the earth cache is virtual. So I see lots of, wow, lots of old virtual, lots of people who want to submit their train station, you know.
And like, say that's not a geological or attribute.
But that's the thing. They look at it and think they're trying to, they have this great idea for a virtual, and they just look and go, you know, I don't see a virtual button, and they keep reading through, and that somebody, it says, I think it says, you know, earth caches are a type of virtual cache, and people go, oh, well, that's got to be it. So I, you know, there's a lot of those where people, you know, try to make a cool view or a building, or, you know, in where do I make a virtual? And so geocache, you know, earth caches kind of pop in.
Yeah. Now, if you were to make a major distinction, because I don't think we actually covered this yet, if you were to make a major distinction of what defines an earth cache, what would that be?
Well, what you hear a lot is that it's based on earth science. The the problems that a lot of people have is, what is the definition of earth science?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you have to think that the people who are sponsoring it is the Geological Society of America, and their definition is, you know, earth caches help explain the process to create and the weathering of the earth. So basically anything that's, you know, minerals, you know, erosion-based, tend to fall, you know, stuff like that tend to fall in an earth cache, where, you know, history doesn't fall in an earth cache really. Like we see a lot of people that write up, and it really, it's like a virtual, like a history of a how a dam was created. And really, it's not, there's no geology in it. It's just right. kind of a history lesson of the site.
Have you noticed over the years that you've been doing this, that whether it's Groundspeak or, you know, is it earthcache.org? Are they separate from Groundspeak, or are they the same thing?
They're separate. Earthcache.org is run by the Geological Society of America.
Okay. Have you noticed over the years, have they been changing, getting a lot more strict in terms of actually getting a earthcache out? Or is it pretty much, you know, if it's got this, it's good to go? Or are they getting more strict, saying, okay, now it has to also include this, or, you know, or we have too many of this kind or too many of that kind, you know?
Yeah, it is more strict. And part of that is, you know, Gary and Matt, they're the two, GeoAware and the GeoAware headquarters, they work for the Geological Society. And they were looking at, by themselves, 700 or 800 caches a year or more.
Wow. Wow.
And they were inundated. That was back in the day. If you remember early on, you went to the Earth Cache website, and you didn't create a cache page. You submitted all the information on the site, and then they would create your cache page and do the work and publish it.
Really?
And so they had a lot of work involved doing it. And, you know, they've actually said there's a whole bunch of caches that now we look at it going back probably shouldn't have been published at the time. But when you're having to look at, you know, 40 caches in a week, and half of those are in foreign languages.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just say that because, like, I've seen a lot of earth caches that are really, really good. I've done a bunch of them. I've also seen some that are like, really? That, you know, that's an earth cache? You know.
Yeah, and I hope, you know, I don't think this is universal, but I hope if you look close, a lot of the ones that seem kind of mediocre were usually some of the older ones.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah, they were and, you know, nothing really new, and now it's a lot more in depth. And
when they brought us on board, they also said, I mean, there was, I think, six of us to start with, and they said, okay, you know, we want to watch this a little closer, screen them a little better, and make sure that they're on topic. And about that same time, he came out with the rule of no photographs for earth caches.
Really?
So if you look at the guidelines, it's, you know, you can't have a photograph for an earth cache unless it serves a specific reason to document the site. And that's actually pretty rare if you think about it. Mm-hmm. But most people want a photograph because really they want to make sure someone's there. They don't want to read the answers that get emailed in.
Right.
Them, I think. But, and I, you know, to be honest, I was pretty negative on that change at first. I didn't think it would work. But, you know, I think over time we can kind of see that really it has worked, and it makes people pay attention to the logging tasks.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, usually it's a picture. I mean, the ones, most of them that I've seen, I've done a couple of older ones where a picture, but I know they've changed it where you don't have to put a picture anymore. But I've noticed there's, as newer earth caches come out, the logging requirements get greater and greater. You know, I've seen.
Yeah, and so, you know, we try to, and we did a major rewrite, I think, in December, January, I think, this year, where we, all the earth cache reviewers kind of threw input in and said, here's problems that we've seen, and they threw in, here's complaints that we've seen, and kind of rewrote it to make it a little more clear for the people wanting to create a cache. Because, you know, we want to educate the people. That's the purpose. And you have to think that's the purpose of the Geological Society, isn't to just show off some site on the side of the road. They want to educate the people.
Mm-hmm.
And so your tasks are, you're supposed to teach somebody about this unique site, and then you're supposed to have them answer the questions and show that they learned something, not what's the third word on the sign,
right, yeah,
or something like that. So a lot of those kind of things have kind of been weeded out. We don't see as many, we don't publish as many that have stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think also I have to say the simple earth caches, in a lot of places, the simple earth caches, I think, are kind of gone.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, they're taken. If you went to Zion's National Park, for example, there's already a cache at the Narrows, and there's already an earth cache at the Weeping Wall that they have there, and there's already an earth cache. And those are the ones that the parks publish little flyers on.
Mm-hmm.
And have write-ups on. So those are the ones that are easy to do, because everyone that goes through the park gets the little flyer, and they can go home and start typing it up and then contact the park to make sure that's okay, and then it gets published. Well, you know, it's kind of harder when all those little sites tend to be taken, so you start kind of have to start digging or hunting for stuff.
Yeah. How do they come up with a nice balance? Is that something that you guys help the person that's making the earth cache? Because I don't know if it's a complaint per se, as more of an observation. People want to find earth caches, but they don't want a semester in geology.
Oh,
that type of thing.
One of my complaints is some people turn their earth cache into a doctoral thesis.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I've done so.
And, you know, sometimes, you know, we try to tell people, I've tried to tell people don't like that. And especially when you're reading it on your little phone, or even worse, try to read that on my Garmin, Oregon. And I'm trying to, you know, pan the screen up little by little, you know, and you get like 15 words at a time, and it goes on and on and on, and where are the logging tasks? And then I run out of characters.
Yeah.
And I have no logging tasks. But, you know, ultimately it's their cache, and if it relates, we let them have a long thing, but I, you know, it's really hard because a lot of these people really put a lot into them, and mm-hmm. by the time they get there, they really don't want to start trimming out. And the other thing is, and it's similar to that, is somebody comes to us and does, say, an earth cache on a swampy area, and the write-up is on the swamp, and it's on the trees, and it's on the animals that live there, and the ecology there, and we'll go in and say, you know, the focus of your earth cache needs to be on the geology, not the ecology. And so they write some history, and we say, well, you know, you want to be on the geology, not the history and the ecology that you still have there. And then they write some geology, and you say, well, you have some geology, but you still have all this other stuff that kind of looks like it makes up the majority of your cache page. So they write more geology and then more geology so that it becomes the focus, only because they've written a thesis.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, those are hard, and those are actually some of my most difficult to review, because some people put a lot of work in them and a lot of effort. They spend a lot of time, and if you tell people, you know, if you could just make it a little smaller,
yeah,
and they just, yeah, and they take that one sentence out. How's that? I throw my hands in the air.
See, my preference has always been, when you have that listing, to have those logging requirements right at the top and then give all the information, because that way,
yeah,
you know, going into
here,
it, what you need right away. And then if you need that extra information, you can go and read it all.
Yeah, they never do that, Daryl. They never do that.
I've had a couple of them that have gone that
really
way. Yeah.
I've never seen that.
It's
I've
rare.
Also, you know, recommended to people, put your logging tasks in the short description.
Yeah, there you go. That's a good one too. Separate.
And then it'll be in its own section.
Right.
And if they won't, if your logging tasks won't fit in the short description, maybe you have a problem.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, so if somebody is saying, you know, I really do want to make an Earth cache. I'm in a hot spot. I know Michigan is one because all the different things of the ice ages that have done so many different things to create the state and all the different formations and types of rocks that have been generated there. I want to make a Earth cache. If you had a hot list of what you would use to get that started off, what would you recommend?
I think the first two steps that I'd use before I even started to hunt for a site would be read the guidelines, and there's links to that to the geocaching.com help center, which kind of takes the guidelines into a little bigger section and will explain out, you know, like the guidelines will say it needs to be related to geology or to earth science, and the link will say earth science is considered this, 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 this. It is not considered history, ecology, you know, and it'll kind of help people to get on track first. And then I think then after those two, find something that interests you. You know, if it's not going to be interesting to you, it's not going to be interesting to somebody else. Mm-hmm. In general, except for the hardcore geology nerds. Yeah. But outside of that, pick something you're interested in and maybe have some knowledge of, and then go out and look for sites that may fall into those categories. And you may stumble across sites. You might be able to go to a state park or a national park nearby or someplace else and see and they'll have a pamphlet on or something on it. You know, I have some books called Geology of Utah, Roadside Geology of Utah, and it actually has, you look up the road, the ID number, like Highway 15 or, you know, Interstate 50, I-70 or something like that. And then it maps out down the road and will tell you as you go down the road geological sites that are down the road at each point. And you can kind of stop and say, huh, does this work? Does it not work? Is this something that... And that's where I've put a lot of my earth caches together I know that's where some other people who have a lot of earth caches tend to get them out of those books. So as they're touring the United States, they'll see something really cool on this little thing and pull over and say, that's it. That's where we can start.
Yeah, my folks were both rock hounds, and we spent a good part of my life in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan for doing exactly that, getting the local books, getting the other known books of the different type of rocks that you could go for, from Lake Superior agate to dolomite to whatever you want to get into. The stories are long and funny of the things that we have done as we have gone on our adventures when you go for this stuff. And I could think of a dozen right off the top of my head that I would love to make as an earth cache. I think one of the things that you really need to kind of emphasize would be the review process on this. This is not a lampskirt hide when you're trying to get this passed and the length of time it takes to actually get an approval.
Right. You know, I would say for myself, I take on average 2 to 3 weeks in preparation before I actually write the page up. And most people, if you have had your Earth cache published, like if you submit your Earth cache and you go home and all of a sudden it's published in the next few days, you are one of probably the small minority because very few people have really read through everything and then have followed the guidelines appropriately. and have the science right. That's right. Another aspect.
I know many people who have tried to put an Earth cache out, but got denied. But
I've been looking at some in your neck of the woods up in Montana, right?
No. I'm in Chicago.
He's in Chicago. We're east side. Corey's the one that's up in Montana.
Oh, okay, Corey's in Montana, but you know, there's a group up there, and I see theirs, and they kind of have struggled through. And one of the really hard kinds of earth caches that a lot of people try to do is the cool mountain that's way over there.
Mm-hmm.
And the hard part is how do you do a logging task? You'd want to teach somebody about the mountain, and usually that's not too hard to find the educational stuff of how a mountain range was created. But how do you do a logging task that relates directly to that I can't just open Street View and get the answer on?
Right.
And so it's really hard to do something at a distance because you can't, you know, you're not there. It's easy to take a photo of. Where the earth caches that people end up getting published the most, that have the most success in getting them published in a timely manner, are ones that I can stand there and I can look at this rock and I can tell the person about it, or I can look at the, you know, the hoodoos or the plateau up close, or the type of rock, mm-hmm. you know, the jasper or whatever, and kind of explain what I'm seeing to the person, rather than saying, well, I see a mountain over there and it's kind of pointed and there's some rocks on it.
Right.
You know, I can do that with any photograph taken from the site. So we're trying to be able to say, can you prove someone's there with a question like that? And usually the answers are no. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's just people can't get close. Some areas are off limits and they can't get closer to do them. So they try to do them at a distance, and those tend to be very problematic for people. And then they get discouraged. And I understand that. The other thing that discourages people sometimes is just getting permission.
Yeah.
I had one at, it's called Horseshoe Bend in, Arizona, just by Page, Arizona. And it's located in Lake Powell is the lake, but I'm trying to think, Canyonlands National Park, National Recreation Area. So it's managed by the National Park Service. And at one time, when I looked at that location, there was like 8 earth caches all in process at that one spot. And the other spot is Rainbow Bridge, that I had 7 or 8 earth caches at those locations. And no one was getting permission. And finally, there was a lady who called the Park Service. They kept emailing the Park Service to get permission. And never heard back and never heard back. Finally, a lady just called, and the Park Service said, oh, yeah, that's great. Yeah, we'll send an email, a letter, and everything will be good. And we got it published without any problem. But these other people tried to email, and you have to think that, you know, national parks are understaffed, they're overworked, and if something comes across in this batch email to the park that's not urgent for them, they're going to just put it on the shelf and you'll probably never hear from it. So the people who tend to call got permission, and then everybody's like, oh man, I was trying.
Yeah, you know, I had the same problem. I wanted to do something on Area 51 with the salt flats. Just couldn't get it. I tried, and just no luck. That was a joke. Sorry, it's getting late. Speaking of getting late, you know, thanks for a nice. Is there any final things that you'd like to say as far as for earth caches in general? Are they getting more popular, less popular, staying the same? How's that working?
You know, I've watched, there's a, in the earth cache forum on geocaching.com, there's someone who's been throwing out statistics. He's actually pulled up the pocket queries for all the earth caches in the world and pulled in all the logs and got all the stuff and running numbers. And, you know, the numbers, unfortunately, can tell you almost whatever however you want to interpret them. You know, you can say, well, there's not as many Earth caches submitted now as before, and so things are not as interested. People aren't as interested in it. And you can say, well, but the easy Earth caches have already been placed.
Right.
The ones at all the tourist stops tend to have already been placed. Mm-hmm. Or the national parks, or, you know, go into Yellowstone and try to find a place for one, and you're going to have a rough time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's still a lot of people that are very interested and love them, and especially because there's not virtuals, there's a group that are just almost fanatical about them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, going, they love to go do these things where they see something new and they learn something. And then there's other people who just don't care. They don't want to put the work in. So everyone kind of has their own thing. And I think there's a niche here that some people really love, other people just don't care about, and others will do them when they run across them.
Well, that's like they have geocaching in general. You know, you do what you want to do and you do what you enjoy. And for the people that it's available, that's a great thing.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people, and we're not talking about the casual geocacher, the person who, you know, has their new GPS and goes out earth caching or goes out caching, you know, for a weekend every 6 months or something,
right,
which is where a lot of cachers fall into. We're talking about the hardcore cachers, I'd say like us, who when we plan trips, we start looking at maps and where are we going to go and how are we going to get there. And usually once people start looking at routes, it seems like the first things they look for are where are Earth caches and virtuals.
Yeah.
Because you kind of know, for the most part, the quality of what you're getting. Some may not be good, but some are really cool, and they take you to cool spots. So it tends to be a lot of those tend to be the first things people pull on a list, especially if you don't know the area and you don't know what's a cool cache. Because I think if I'm traveling across Colorado, my wife would kill me if I try to stop for every, you know, film canister along the route. But if I stop at some of these cool spots and then grab a big cache or something here or there, that's fine. So if I got to limit my number of stops, now I've got to pick. And I think those tend to be high on the pick list of, you know, if I'm going to, oh, there's this along this route, that'll be a stop. And then they look at what else is along the route.
Awesome. All right. Well, unfortunately, we're running a bit late, but I'll tell you what, Fire Nice, thank you so much for being on the show. And we always get a really good talk every time we have you on. And sure, we look forward to the next time, because Earth caching, hey, the world keeps a changing. And I got a ton of other questions to ask you, too. But thank you so much.
Okay.
Please be sure to join us each and every Wednesday at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time for another episode of the Geocaching Podcast, right here on the Geocaching Podcast website at www.geocachingpodcast.com/live. The video version of our show is available on YouTube, and the audio version is available on the home website, iTunes, Stitcher, and many of your favorite podcatchers. We love hearing from our viewers and listeners, so please visit us through our social media sites or contact us via our voicemail line at 630-31-VOICE. The Geocaching Podcast is a Head Hard Hat production and is produced by Daryl Wattenberg and Andy Smith. This show is copyright 2014 by Andrew T. Smith. All rights reserved.